Welcome, everybody, to my Tchaikovsky podcast for our upcoming All Tchaikovsky program, Saturday, April 10th. On the program, Tchaikovsky's Valse from Sleeping Beauty, his Rococo Variations for Cello Solo and Orchestra, and his Symphony No. 2, also called Little Russian. Tchaikovsky may be the most universally loved composer. If you think about it, his music is timeless, beautiful, one earworm after the other. The Nutcracker, his first piano concerto, March Love. His music reached pop culture status, to the point that I just lost a bet to my 17-year-old son, who doesn't have anything to do with classical music. Here's what happened. Since 2 weeks, I'm studying Tchaikovsky's Symphony No. 2, with the result that I can't get the melody of the second theme of the last movement out of my head. Alright, you got it. So this morning I was singing it randomly in the kitchen without stopping. My 17-year-old is getting ready for the day, standing right next to me. So, just for fun, I'm telling him with lots of bravura, going completely over the top, Jack, if you can tell me the composer of this melody I'm singing right now, I will give you $100. All right, maybe I was a little too cocky, but to be fair, in our family, the only composers allowed mentioning are German ones. I'm kidding. Still, we never talk about Tchaikovsky, ever. Always Beethoven or Mozart. So $100, sure, why not? It's just a joke. He won't know. In his free time, he hangs out with his friends playing ice hockey and basketball. Well, guess what? The first word coming out of his mouth immediately after I had suggested the little wager. Tchaikovsky, he says. We couldn't stop laughing. Well, in the next 25 minutes, you will find out more about Tchaikovsky, this Russian romantic soul. Let's start at the beginning. Tchaikovsky's dad was a manager in an iron factory in Votkinsk, a small town in the Ural region of Russia. His mother was actually German, born in Meissen. On his father's side, Tchaikovsky was born into a family with a long military history. He had 6 siblings, one of them becoming a senator in later years, another a playwright and author of the first biography about him, Tchaikovsky. He wrote his first song when he was 4 years old, together with his 3-year-old sister, Alexandra. It was called Our Mama in Petersburg. It's very cute. He started piano lessons with 5. With 10, though, his parents enrolled him into the preparatory class of the Imperial School of Jurisprudence, as he was supposed to follow the footsteps of his ancestors, working in the bureaucratic system of Russia. So, with 10 years old, he started to live alone in a boarding school in St. Petersburg, which gave him a lifelong trauma from separation from his mom. But not only this, his mom died 4 years later, leaving him in a deep state of shock. After passing the entrance exam for the actual School of Jurisprudence, he enrolled in their choir, one musical endeavor at the time. He later wrote, "My voice was a splendid soprano, and for several years in succession, I took the first line in the trio, which on the occasions was sung by the 3 boys at the altar at the beginning and end of the liturgy." Tchaikovsky studied to become a civil servant. During those 9 years, he did write some music. There was an opera, Hyperbola, a valse, a song, Mezzetta Notte. But compared to other composers we performed this season and other composers I had talked about in previous podcasts, there was no sign that Tchaikovsky would become a composer during his entire teenage years. Just think of Ravel or Prokofiev or Beethoven. Prokofiev went to his conservatory audition 13 years old with 2 heavy folders of compositions. Ravel, on the other hand, had no formal education, but enrolled in the Paris Conservatory with 14. Or Beethoven, who did nothing else but play and write music as a teenager. Tchaikovsky, did the opposite. With 19, he simply graduated as a titular counselor, after which he became a junior assistant, then senior assistant. The only other exciting thing during his school years was that he fell in love. He fell in love with one of the other students, Sergei Kiryev. Tchaikovsky's brother, Modest Tchaikovsky, called it in the autobiography as one of the strongest, most durable, and purest amorous infatuations of Tchaikovsky's life. He said, "It possessed all charms, all sufferings, all depth and force of love, most luminous and sublime." And that without Tchaikovsky's passion for Kiryev, the music of Romeo and Juliet, of The Tempest, and of Francesca da Rimini is not entirely comprehensible. End of quote. But music itself, lessons, composing, performing, very, very little. It was not until his early 20s that Tchaikovsky started taking actual music and composition lessons. With 21 years old, he enrolled in the Russian Musical Society with classes in harmony, orchestration, and composition. 1 year later, in 1862, the St. Petersburg Conservatory opened, and Tchaikovsky continued with the same professors, amongst them Nikolai Rubinstein, learning about both Russian and Western traditions. But he needed 2 more years to fully change his course in life. With 23, it finally happened. Tchaikovsky resigned from his government job and full-heartedly turned to music. After 13 years of his life trying to become a government bureaucrat with lifelong securities, he plunged right into the rough and unpredictable waters of the artist's life. In the meantime, he became quite a controversial student. On the one hand, his teacher, Nikolai Rubinstein, called him a composer of genius. Yet, after having handed the orchestral score of an overture called The Storm, the 24-year-old was shredded to pieces. Rubinstein was livid. How could he? Tchaikovsky had composed such thick, romantic, and Russian music. But not only this. How could he have used forbidden instruments? The harp, English horn, tuba? Rubinstein was beyond himself. Don't you recognize that kind of story? When I talked about Prokofiev, there were exactly the same relations between the student Prokofiev and his teachers, just several years later after Tchaikovsky. Well, back to Tchaikovsky. Tchaikovsky learned to stick to his guts and trust his own instincts. All right. Remember, with 25 years old, Ludwig von Beethoven gave his first public concert in Vienna, whereas Mozart, with 25 years old, was a celebrity all over Europe and started writing his opera, The Abduction of the Seraglio. Tchaikovsky, on the other hand, 25 years old, after having studied music for 4 years, was offered a professorship in the opening year of the Moscow Conservatory. He was nowhere near the accomplishments of many of his famous composer compatriots. But again, a good wine needs time to mature. After Tchaikovsky finished his studies, things progressed. He wrote his first symphony with 28, his first opera called The Voyevoda with 29 years old, the tone poem Romeo and Juliet also with 29, his second symphony with 32, and the third symphony with 35. So, not too bad, almost similar to Beethoven's output. On a side note, Tchaikovsky was present at the inaugural performance of Wagner's Ring, Richard Wagner's Ring of the Nibelungen, in Bayreuth in 1876, And Tchaikovsky wrote, "The music is unlikely nonsense through which, from time to time, sparkle unusually beautiful and astonishing details." End of quote. Let's talk Russia for a moment. Tchaikovsky lived in the Russia of the Tsar. The Tsar, which derives from the Latin word Caesar, Caesar meant emperor, and was a term that started in 1547, given to the supreme ruler of the Tsardom of Russia and the Russian Empire. 1547. Well, to be completely precise, the term was used for the very first time by the ruler of Bulgaria, Simon the First of Bulgaria. Tsar Simon the Great. And when was that? Well, a little earlier, in 893. Again, same thing, coming from the Latin word Caesar, Caesar, meaning emperor. Back to Russia. The first ruler named Tsar was none other than Ivan the Terrible. I won't get into him or his fearsome name, only that at the time a group of reformers known as the Chosen Council united around young Ivan, declaring him Tsar, Emperor of all Rus, in 1547, at his age of 16 years old, establishing the Tsardom of Russia. All right, let's jump ahead 300 years. Tchaikovsky lived under Tsar Alexander II, who reigned from 1855 to 1881. Quite a long time. Alexander II would turn out to be the third last Tsar of all times, as there would only be two more after him. Alexander III and Nicholas II, who would be executed in 1918 during the Russian Revolution, putting an end to the emperors and empresses of Russia. During Tchaikovsky's time, though, the emperor, the Tsar, was still the center of political life. And that particular one, Alexander II, was a man of liberal disposition. Russia of the 19th century was a country of agriculture and peasants. One of Alexander II's major reforms was to emancipate 20 million serfs. And that is from a population of about 60 million total. Also, he implemented the great judicial reform under which system Russia is still functioning today. He relaxed censorship with the results of universities having greater freedom of expression. He initiated a massive push to education. It was during his reign that the education of the peasant masses started on a vast scale. And it was under his reign that Russia received a stable currency, that the railroad was built and expanded, and the army reformed. Overall, a good time. Yet, not that good, as that Alexander II would not have been killed. He was assassinated by revolutionaries that thought his reforms were not reaching far enough. His son, Alexander III, called the peacemaker, took over and went backwards in a period of political counter-reforms. Tchaikovsky was born into the Russia of the Tsar. He was born into the Russia of the Orthodox Russian faith and, again, the Russia of a mostly peasant population. He was born into a world of reforms. And he was born into a new philosophical movement, the Russia of the Nihilists. The Nihilists movement turned out to be an extension of the Enlightenment of Western Europe. And the Nihilist movement turned out to be the breeding ground of the upcoming revolution. Nihilists favored the destruction of human institutions and laws based on the assumption that such institutions and laws are artificial and corrupt. At its core, Russian nihilism was characterized by the belief that the world lacks comprehensible meaning objective truth or value. For some time, many Russian liberals had been dissatisfied by what they regarded as the empty discussions of the upper classes. The nihilists questioned all old values and shocked the Russian establishment, creating an image of the tormented soul. The term started in its idea with Alexander Pushkin, the poet, at the beginning of the 19th century. It was popularized by Ivan Turgenev years later in his celebrated novel Father and Sons from 1862. Russian nihilism, as stated in the Routledge Encyclopedia of Philosophy, quote, is perhaps best regarded as the intellectual pool of the period from 1855 to 1866, out of which later radical movements emerged, end of quote. Mikhail Bakunin, himself an anarchist, in his book Reaction in Germany from 1842 wrote, "Let us therefore trust the eternal spirit which destroys and annihilates only because it is the unfathomable and eternal source of all life. The passion for destruction is a creative passion." End of quote by Mikhail Bakunin from 1842, speaking about nihilists. Russia of the Tsar, of peasants, of nihilists. There's one other thing I would like to mention, though, when talking about Tchaikovsky's Russia. The Russian soul. I'm sure you have heard the term before. It comes up here and there, the Russian soul. It's nothing political or demographic. It has been used in literature in reference to the uniqueness of the Russian national identity. Many Russian writers, such as Nikolai Gogol, Leo Tolstoy, and Dostoevsky, offer descriptions of the Russian soul. The Russian soul evolved and entered into Western consciousness, most famously through the work of Dostoevsky. In his novels and stories, Dostoevsky exhibited an often anti-European nationalism and frequently suggested a people's spirit, held together by unexpressed, unconscious ideas which are merely strongly felt. By Dostoevsky's death in 1881, the Russian soul had completed its evolution in Russia. He had the following opinion about the freedom and strength of the Russian soul. Quote, Dostoevsky says, "It's frightening how free a Russian man's spirit is, how strong is his will. No one has ever been so much torn away from his native soil as he sometimes had to be. Nobody ever took a turn so sharp as he, following his own belief." End of quote by Dostoevsky. Russia's poets and writers are amongst the most genius the world ever produced. Pushkin, Gogol, Dostoevsky, Tolstoy. The Russia of Tchaikovsky is the Russia of the Russian soul, a Russia of archetypes, created by its literary giants. A Russia ultimately reflected through Tchaikovsky's music. Let's briefly talk about Pushkin, Dostoevsky, and Tolstoy. First, Pushkin. He lived from 1799 to 1837, so he only lived till his 38th year. Pushkin is considered to be Russia's greatest poet, although, as I just said, he only lived till his 38th year, as he was killed in a duel. In his masterpiece, Eugene Onegin, which he wrote in 1833, he created a type of character imitated many times after, the extravagant, superfluous man. Russian archetypes created through his poets. Eugene Onegin tells the story of, well, Eugene Onegin, a disillusioned individual born into wealth and privileges, bored with society, feeling himself morally and intellectually superior. He rejects the advances of beautiful Tatiana and rather lives alone, not wanting to compromise his freedom, until he starts regretting his decisions, growing old and lonely. Tchaikovsky used the story for his opera with the same name, Eugene Onegin, the extravagant, superfluous anti-hero, bored with society and life. All right, then there is Dostoevsky. Dostoevsky lived from 1821 to 1881. He is creating a new type of novel, psychological, where the story itself isn't as important as the unconscious and emotional underpinnings of the characters. And that happened years before Sigmund Freud. In his masterpiece, in Dostoevsky's masterpiece Crime and Punishment from 1866, he creates an anti-hero through the main character, Raskolnikov, whom the reader follows through all his fears, anxieties, and actions. Raskolnikov is poor. The city and other characters are seen through Raskolnikov's eyes. And Dostoevsky does everything to draw us deeper into the story and into Raskolnikov's mind, the mind of a murderer. Because, as you might know, Raskolnikov kills. Yet, he feels to be above society. Justification of the murder comes from feeling disgust with society. Raskolnikov thinks he is allowed to kill because he sees that everybody else is just ordinary. After the murder, Raskolnikov's real struggle unfolds, either living with the torments of guilt or the torments of the official punishment. Again, a Russian archetype created through one of her most famous writers, Dostoevsky. During Russia's Golden Age, Leo Tolstoy was the third writer who changed the course of literature. Tolstoy was born 1828, so a little later after Pushkin and Dostoevsky, and he died in 1910. Traditional literature of old and folkloristic Russia was replaced by writing that focused on modern and complex themes. Tolstoy's War and Peace from 1869 tells the stories of the rise and fall of five Russian aristocratic families during the 8 years around Napoleon's battles in Russia of 1812. One of the conclusions of the work, historic events are not driven by the actions of great leaders, but by countless ordinary events. Another archetype, the power of the common man. So, here we are, Tchaikovsky's Russia. A country with a huge landmass, a mostly peasant population, an old Tsarist system, steps towards reformation and modernizations through the Tsar Alexander II, the third last Tsar, a newly evolving powerful nihilistic movement based on Enlightenment thoughts of Western Europe becoming the breeding ground of revolutionary ideas, and the development of a Russian soul through the writings of its literary giants from Pushkin to Dostoevsky, with Russian archetypes, the bored and snobbish rich, the one standing above the ordinary, and last but not least, the idea of the power of the common man. Let's turn to Tchaikovsky's music. As we discovered, Tchaikovsky was a late starter. All those years, though, he had one idol, Mozart. None else made such an impression on him. No other Russian composer before him, not Beethoven or Bach or Wagner, it was Mozart. He writes to his patron, Nadezhda von Meck, quote, "How I felt on hearing Don Giovanni when Donna Anna, that stately, vengeful, proud figure of a woman, was on stage. Nothing in any opera has made such a strong impact on me. I so love the music of Don Giovanni that, even as I write to you, I could weep with emotion and excitement." End of quote. Later he writes in his diary that he had come to love everything in Mozart, for we love everything in the man to whom we are really devoted. I do not claim that each and every one of his works is a masterpiece, and yet I love each one because they are his, because he has engraved each one with his sacred hand." End of quote. Tchaikovsky called Mozart, quote, "the Messiah of music." And there is one other influence for Tchaikovsky: Russian folk music. During the second half of the 19th century, a bitter fight was brewing between the old guard of Russian composers, represented by Nikolai Rubinstein, his former teacher, who favored the German masters, and the so-called group of the Five: Balakirev, Kui, Mussorgsky, Rimsky-Korsakov, and Borodin, who favored Russian material and independence from the West. Tchaikovsky was caught in the middle. He was a composer inspired by Mozart in a deeply Russian environment, with himself the artist with all his pains and triumphs at the center of his music. Romanticism is concerned with self-expression, with the mood of the moment, with fiery impulses and the conflicts of the soul. The form of a symphony, though, is concerned with structure and rules. The question is, how do romantic composers combine the sense of the mood, of the moment, with structure? How did Tchaikovsky put the square into the circle? And did he succeed? Let's turn to his second symphony, The Little Russian. The first references to the symphony begin to appear in Tchaikovsky's letters from November 1872. On November 14th, he wrote to his brother, quote, "My conscience is tormenting me for not writing to you, but what can I do when the symphony which I'm finishing off has engrossed me so deeply that I'm not able to do anything else? The writing of this work of genius, as Nikolai Dmitrievich Kondratyev calls my symphony, is nearing its end, and as soon as the parts are ready, it will be performed. I think this is my best creation in terms of perfection, of form, a quality which I've hitherto failed to achieve." End of quote. The symphony has four movements. It's about 35 minutes long and was conceived for a mid-size orchestra. Three of the movements are based on different Ukrainian folk songs. Let's take a closer look. The first movement starts with a short and loud tutti chord, like saying hello. Leading right into the first Ukrainian folk song, a slow, melancholic melody played by the French horn called Down by Mother Volga. And here is the text of that folk song. Quote, "Down the Volga, Mother Volga, over the wide sheet of water, there rises a thunderstorm, a huge thunderstorm. Nothing is to be seen in the waves. There is only a small black ship with glistening white sails. The oarsmen have dark caps, and their belts are shiny red. Their leader is dressed up too, in a long cloak made of black velvet. Now their leader begins to speak. Let us sing our song, boys. Let it sound down the Volga, Mother Volga, over the wide sheet of water." End of quote. In the slow introduction, the melody is heard five more times until it sinks into darkness. With the begin of the allegro section of the first movement, a faster idea emerges in the woodwinds, the official first theme which is repeated in the strings and developed. After a short outburst, Tchaikovsky introduces a lyrical second theme, again starting in the woodwinds. A chromatic rise connects to a forceful end of the exposition section. After the introduction of the two main themes, there's a short development section where Tchaikovsky takes the ideas apart and works them. First, he strings together the Ukrainian melody, then takes the first four notes of the first theme and repeats again and again. With Volga sailors intoning again their melancholic song in the horn, and the music ends in silence. The second movement starts with a distinct march in pianissimo, very quietly, from far off. Tchaikovsky's military background is evoked, yet from a time long ago. It leads into the second Ukrainian folk song, Spin, O My Spinner, a melancholic melody in C minor played by the woodwinds. Tchaikovsky is repeating his technique from the first movement of repeating his melodies again and again, each time in a different color. It gives the symphony overall a hypnotic character. The third movement, the scherzo, is flying along in a three pattern, exciting and ferocious. And the last movement, the fourth movement, well, let me just say, wow, and oh gosh. It is based on the Ukrainian folk song The Crane. The structure is simple. After an initial slow introduction of the melody by the full orchestra, that melody is repeated again and again and again. At the end, you will have heard the melody 34 times in the last movement. Boring? Nope, definitely not. The melody is repeated, accompanied by shifting harmonies, textures, and backgrounds, one variation after the other.
Thank you.
The second theme in the last movement, that tune I couldn't get out of my head when I sang it to my 17-year-old this morning, gets a similar treatment. It is repeated several times. Tchaikovsky doesn't mutate his melodies like Mahler later. He keeps them intact. It's as if he gives birth to a child. The child stays. Only the circumstances change. The harmonies, the textures, the drama around the child. The child, the melody itself, stays the same. Tchaikovsky's gifts, like Mozart's, were absolutely catchy melodies. Beethoven didn't do that. Beethoven had a different gift. The moment Tchaikovsky invented one of those beautiful tunes, he kept them. Which means the only way to build his music was by repetition and variation of this entire melody. The symphony is embedded into Tchaikovsky's Russia. The Russia of the Tsar, of the people, of the Russian soul. Again, it starts with the Ukrainian folk melody in the minor key played by one horn. It's as if one person was singing, down by Mother Volga. Haydn, Mozart, Beethoven never started a symphony with one instrument playing the melody. Schubert did this once in his Ninth Symphony, yet he's doing it in the major key. Tchaikovsky is going all the way. One lonely, melancholic voice, the Volga fishers, Russian men working. Part of the Russian soul? The second theme in that first movement is lyrical and chromatic. The Russian woman? The second movement, an emotional connection to Tolstoy's War and Peace with more stories of the people? A masculine march-like first theme, the Russian soldier? The second theme from the folk tune Spin, O My Spinner, again, the Russian woman. And in between, chromatic searching lines, lonely, suffering, maybe Dostoevsky's Raskolnikov from Crime and Punishment. Tchaikovsky most probably didn't think of any of those connections. Yet, he lived right in the middle of it all and knew Tolstoy and Dostoevsky. He was breathing the Russian air, heavy with history. It's more that his music itself is imbued by it all. Maybe consciously, maybe unconsciously. Listening to it, though, transports me back 150 years into a different time. Romantic and beautiful.